Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Andrew Pulver. This week, Zan Brooks steps inside the troubled brain of director Lars von Trier as his controversial psychodrama Antichrist goes on general release. Peter Bradshaw will be joining us to review some of this week's film releases, including Antichrist and Charles Dickens' England. And I'll be meeting the director Anthony Fabian to find out about his feature Skin, the tale of a black child born to white parents in South Africa during the apartheid era, starring Sophie Okonedo and Sam Neill. Yes, it's as tense as a Wild West shootout. It's Film Weekly. Danish director Lars von Trier is no stranger to controversy, as previous films like Breaking the Waves, Dogville and Mandalay have demonstrated. His new film is Antichrist, starring Charlotte Gainsbourg and Willem Dafoe. They play a grieving couple whose young son has died, and as an extreme form of therapy, they retreat to a cabin in the woods, where all hell breaks loose.
Okay, Mr. Nature. What do you want?
To hurt you as much as I can.
How?
How do you think?
By frightening me.
By killing you.
Zan Brooks spoke to Lars von Trier about Antichrist and asked him if he had deliberately set out to provoke audiences with his film.
One thing is to know that it will be taken provocative, but that's not how you navigate, I think, in a film. Or anyway, I don't. I like to say that I'm provoking myself, you know, which is true also. And through that, I'm provoking others.
But how do you feel personally then, as somebody who goes to the Cannes Film Festival with your newborn baby, and then provokes that kind of visceral response? Mm-hmm. Do you take that personally? Are you secretly pleased by it? How do you adapt to that?
Oh, I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased. I think that there were some journalists that went a little over. The line by saying that I should justify myself. I think that was a little too. You could maybe, which I'm not going to do, justify the film, but justify myself, I think, was a little over the line. If you asked me before and if you ask me now how a film should be received, then it would be with some people that hate it and some people that like it.
I'm going to read you a quote from another review of the time.
Okay.
That said that Antichrist is quote proof that Lars von Trier hates women. How do you respond to that?
It's interesting how you can see a film of proof of anything. Well, when you make a film, it's not a statement. I don't believe that, you know, in Breaking the Waves there were some bells up in the sky. You know, I don't believe that there are bells in the sky.
Mm.
You know, it's a fictional tale. I prefer being with women than men, absolutely. No, hating them, that would be like kind of hating elephants. That would be really strange, wouldn't it?
Is it hurtful, though, if somebody accuses you of rampant misogyny?
Because it's so much nonsense that I can't take it seriously.
I was also speaking to Charlotte Gainsbourg at the festival.
Yes.
And she said that she felt that she was playing you.
Yes, but I think that is very true. That in many of my films, I one way of writing scripts is that you take your own personality and you kind of divide it up into different persons. And I think that's what I'm doing very much. And if anybody is me in the film, it's the her character.
That does imply that you were in a very, very dark place when you were making this film.
Yes, but anxiety and stuff I've felt all my life, and that can be very serious, very serious. So yes, it's experiences.
The kind of the key line in Antichrist is spoken by the fox, who says that chaos reigns.
Is yes.
Does that reflect your own worldview?
Oh. Anyway, that is very much what you will agree to if you are in a phase of heart anxiety. But this whole thing with the fox, and you know, a lot of people said, but why does a fox speak? That is ridiculous. Yes, maybe it is, but that's, again, it's kind of the fox demanded to have a line. You know, I'm washing my hands a little bit.
You don't argue with the fox.
No, you don't. I actually, all these images of animals are images from my former life, where I did a lot of shamanic journeys, and there you speak to the animals under these shamanic journeys. I don't know if you know anything about
it. No, not at all.
No, it's some kind of, you know, the shamans, the yeah. medicine men of,
yeah.
Yeah, was kind of traveling to a parallel world to solve problems and to help people. And they did that on the drum of the beat of the drum, a special drum beat, and then you go into a trance and you can kind of move to this parallel world where you speak with the animals. And there I actually met this fox that was biting itself, and it had a line, so it's difficult to change that.
And what age were you on these shamanic journeys?
I think I was 20 or something.
Right. And that was a helpful process to go through?
It was great fun. Great fun. It's really fantastic because it's actually like some kind of drug, you know, this drum beat. So that you, it's really ridiculous things that happened.
Were there any other animals that you met on the journey as well as the fox?
All the three animals, yes. All three of them I met.
Oh, right. I see. So these are they're coming back into the film from
the past.
Oh,
yes, yes. The bird in the ground and stuff, yes.
Lars, let's look forward now. So what,
yes.
Are you?
Yes, please.
Let's put all this behind us.
Yeah.
You were saying that when you were in the depths of depression, that you worried that you wouldn't actually be able to make a film again.
Mm,
but now you have, and presumably that's been broken. Are you going to go back and complete the US trilogy that we've had, Dogville and Mandalay? Are we going to get Washington, the third film in that?
I don't know. Right now, I'm also, because my partner and I have sold half of the company, so we are really taking a long vacation now, you know. So I don't know. You can't kind of hurry these things. You know, you have to wait and see what film demands to be done.
Lars von Trier, thanks so much for sparing the time to speak to
us. Yes, thank you very much.
All right, good luck.
Yeah, okay, ciao.
Bye-bye.
Antichrist is on general release, certificate 18, from this Friday, the 24th of July. And the full interview with Lars von Trier is available as a film weekly extra. That's well worth downloading. You can find us on iTunes or subscribe to this podcast by going to guardian.co.uk/film. Now, joining me to review this week's releases is Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw. We'll be looking at Antichrist, Once Upon a Time in the West, and Charles Dickens's England. And the film we're going to talk about first is Lars von Trier's Antichrist, which is obviously the big controversial release of the week. So, Peter, we know you really hated it when you saw it in Cannes. Did you change your mind?
Well, I'm not sure that I really hated it. I mean, that I kind of admire, in a way, the technique that is apparent in the movie. And part of me, perhaps the journalist in me, admires the sheer malicious sadism with which Lars von Trier knows exactly how to wind up the commentariat. He knows exactly whose buttons to push and how hard to push them, and how to generate huge amounts of column inches of squawking and spluttering dismay from one and all, from the right and the left, in a way. So I kind of like it, but I think the penny has dropped with me with Lars von Trier. I now know that these films aren't really films. They are hoaxes, basically. They are just wind-ups, brilliant wind-ups. But he's a mischief maker rather than a filmmaker, I think.
Can we divorce the film from him? I mean, if you didn't know that it was a Lars von Trier film, would you get anything out of it?
It's interesting. If you didn't know him, I didn't know it was by him, you would certainly, as I did before I realised what Lars von Trier was up to, would be baffled and stunned at the strange mixture of extreme sentimentality, in a way, extreme, almost brutal kind of tragedy, plus extreme provocation. It's a very distinctive von Trier combo. It was been there in Breaking the Waves and in Dancer in the Dark, and now here. It's not just about self-mutilation, genital mutilation, all the things everybody's chattering about, but also the horrible scene at the beginning where the baby falls to its death, which is a classic von Trier kind of extreme kind of sadness plus extreme horror. It's part of his sort of brilliant sort of double-pronged attack, although it is presented in this sort of exquisitely deadpan way. And there is an element of absurdity running all the way through it. But it's an air of deliberate absurdity, I think. A lot of critics have jumped on the bizarre moments in it where a hallucinating William Dafoe seems to see a fox talking to him. And people have mocked that moment. And when I've seen it in the cinema, the audiences have burst out laughing. I actually thought that was a rather good moment in the film. It was one of the kind of interesting and bold moments in the film.
I have to say, I saw the film. I kind of agree with that. I mean, it sort of, particularly that little bit with the fox, wasn't anything to laugh at.
No,
really.
But I thought it was pretty good.
I mean, what I feel though, one of the things about von Trier is he really puts his actors through it. I'd just be interested to know how you felt the actors were sort of responding to it. Do they have any kind of ironic distance, or are they kind of deeps of his sort of cackling puppeteer?
Well, I think who knows what they really thought of it? I mean, there's a deep strain of professionalism in the acting world, especially in Hollywood, is that once it's all over, you just don't criticize people. There's nothing to be gained in criticizing the director, especially if the film is a hit, then you've kind of, queered your pitch. I think I read an interesting article, I think it was by Todd McCarthy in the Variety, who said that he was impressed by the way that the actors came through it with dignity, in a way that Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg did everything that von Trier could possibly have demanded of them, and they came through it with enormous dignity, and it didn't look as if they'd been put through the mangle. Whereas Nicole Kidman, I think, in Dogville, almost visibly really did look as if she'd been put through the mangle. I really thought that you could sense that she's been having a really tough time, and certainly Bjork, who's kind of weird anyway, it'd be difficult to tell whether she's being put through a mangle or not, but certainly I think Nicole Kidman, you could see a flash of dismay behind her eyes in Dogville. I'm not sure what they did, how they handled it. I'm sure Lars von Trier would have treated them to some good old-fashioned sort of mad director behavior. The great man is notorious for that, and I can't believe that in a movie about going off and going through agony in the forest, he didn't put them through a little bit of real life agony. But if he did, and if they resented it, they certainly did a very good job of covering it up.
And the dedication issue, which referred to before, which has, again, caused a lot of...
It caused a huge amount of hot-under-the-collar outrage from people who don't understand it's a joke. At the end of this extraordinary film, with all the bloodbath and horror, he flashes up a dedication to, of all people, Andrei Tarkovsky, of all the most inappropriate people, which, of course, gets howls of derision in the audience.
I mean, I have to say, I felt that too. You know, for me, Tarkovsky is the sort of master of kind of religious and spiritual insight, and
yes,
to sort of have it at the end of this, which didn't really contain any of that.
No,
was like, God, what is that all about?
What is that all
but
about?
Again,
well, you take 2 seconds to think about it,
yeah,
and you'll find out what it's all about. It's a joke. It's a wind up for. Mm. It's a jab between the ribs for the art house crowd, who are given just enough art house pleasure to invite them to sympathise or engage with the film in then some way, and then step back and slap them in the face. And that's what it's about. Of course it's wrong. It's a deliberate joke.
Okay, and now moving on to the next film, which is the re-release of the cinematic classic Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West, which has had a digital clean-up and is once again on the big screen. Before we start talking about it, let's hear a little bit of it.
I would like some water, if it's no trouble.
Water? Well, you see, that word is poison around these parts ever since the days of the Great Flood.
You mean you never wash?
We sure do.
Well, I'd like to use the same facilities you people do.
You sure can. Just happen to have a full tub in the back. And you're lucky only 3 people have used it this morning.
Used it one at a time or all together?
Okay, Peter, right. So we have a revival of a great Western, great spaghetti Western. What did you make of it?
It's really interesting. My view of it is, I can only say it's kind of evolving in a way. I remember when this was last re-released 10 years ago, in honor of the fact that its new complete cut had come out, which was a whopping 2¾ hours. And I responded, I think probably correctly, in the way that Sergio Leone wanted me to respond, in a kind of hypnotized way to the what I can think of as almost the metaphysical quality of the Western, these weird, unexplained and disquieting presences looming in the desolate landscape. And he loves these wide shots of wilderness panoramas, and then suddenly you'll cut crunchingly with an Ennio Morricone kind of whistle to a huge close-up of some malevolent kind of grizzled face, and the sheer sense of malign forces closing in on you, that sense of death and the fear of death in the burning sun. I kind of loved the first time. I've got to admit that I have a kind of agnostic feeling about it now, mainly because a certain kind of rather banal voice in my head is saying, do we have to be kept in the dark about what's going on for quite such a long period of time? Because it goes on for two and three quarter hours. You are not permitted to find out really what's going on or who these people really are until at least an hour and a half in, which is a hell of a long time to be bemused, to be honest with you.
So what do you make of what happens? I mean, it's sort of Bronson versus Fonda, isn't it?
It's Bronson, yes. Yeah. Bronson, it plays the man with no name, a kind of quasi-Clint Eastwood figure, although he hasn't. He's called Harmonica, which turns out to be the key to his motivation, which, again, that's something which isn't revealed until literally 5 minutes from the end. You just don't know. He appears to be a motiveless force of darkness. Why is it that he is desperate to kill this other sinister gunslinger called Frank? You just don't know until the very end. It's more or less explained. As I say, it's more or less explained an hour and a half in. I kind of don't want to explain it because Sergio Leone obviously didn't want to explain it to you either. And that's why, in a way, the more that as years go by, this film achieves, in a way, a kind of Antonioni status. It's like it's almost like The Passenger, in a way. And I'm not sure. I can't put my hand on my heart and say that's deliberately what Sergio Leone wanted. Did he want metaphysical ambiguity and a strange kind of detachment from narrative, or did he just sort of lose control of this vast amount of footage that he'd shot and couldn't quite put it together in a conventional way? And I'm honestly not entirely sure, although the effect is sort of brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, the reason why I particularly like this film, I mean, yeah. I haven't seen it since the last re-release, is simply that what Leone seemed to fasten on about the old Westerns, which I personally am not a huge fan of the classic Western, but there's elements buried in it of these kind of ritual behaviour in a very anthropological sense.
And absolutely
that, and that's what Leone fastened on with this film, is that it just seems to be sort of building all these sort of confrontations and everybody sort of basically moves like emotionless robots on some level. And that's what he fastened on, and that's where it gets its hypnotic quality from. And that's what I basically found so interesting about it.
I find it interesting too, but as I say, it's something which is creeping up on me. Maybe if I watch it again, I won't care again, but something about me kind of, I don't know what it is. It's a very banal voice in me says, you know, we can have all that, and yet can you not tell us sort of what's going on a bit sooner in so we can sort of understand a bit more what's going on? I don't know. But it's like a kind of visual poem of bleakness. There's a kind of Edward Hopper quality to it. I found something in a way like Polanski's, in a way like Chinatown, in there, especially the theme of water. It's a really interesting theme of the old West. The desolate old West needs water to survive. And that's a really interesting theme. That kind of, I got that from it at the second viewing, which I wasn't aware of in the past. So I think I'll change my mind about this film every time I watch it, in a way. But it's a real landmark.
Once Upon a Time in the West is on release at the BFI South Bank, and hopefully we'll go on a sort of national tour from this Friday, the 24th of July.
When we think about different periods in British history, we tend to refer to them by the names of the monarchs reigning at the time: Georgian, Victorian, Edwardian, Elizabethan. But there are also two writers who have achieved instant recognition. One, of course, is William Shakespeare. The other is Charles Dickens.
And our last film is a film called Charles Dickens England, which I haven't seen, but Peter has a lot to say about this one. So, so Peter, let us have it.
Well, this is quite an extraordinary film. It's a documentary. It's going to get a very brief run in cinemas. It's really intended for a television transmission. It's going to go out on the Sky Arts TV channel in two parts, in fact, and presumably will be sold to TV companies all over the world. I mean, that must be the object of the exercise. It is a tour, a very stately and laid-back tour of almost every single house Charles Dickens lived in throughout his 58 years. And it is presented in what I will delicately describe as a very stately way by Sir Derek Jacobi. Now, almost 5 or 10 minutes into this film, when I watched it with a crowd of very bemused critics and writers, we sort of thought that it might be a joke. We seriously thought that it might be an Armando Iannucci-style massive mockumentary kind of wind-up, and that Derek Jacobi's, frankly, rather Alan Partridge-y performance in front of the camera was a put-on. But I'm afraid it's not. It really does look, as every agonizingly slow minute goes by, like some sort of cult classic. It's something for, I don't know, it's something that would go out on school's telly, I think. And I'm not even sure that it would pass muster as school's telly in a way. It's done so slowly. I mean, it really does. It's the TV or movie equivalent of a 78 RPM record played at 33 and a third. It is quite extraordinary. I think in a way it's one of the most extraordinary things I've seen in the last few months. And poor Derek Jacobi, he just looks like he's in an advert for life insurance for the over 60s.
So is this a recommendation or not? Can't quite work out where you're coming from.
It sort of is a recommendation in a way. I mean, I hate kind of smirking kind of so bad it's good kind of reviews. And I think the number of films that really are like that are few and far between. Most films are so bad it's bad. But this is, I don't know, it's not so much so bad it's good, but it's so slow, it's surreal. I mean, it is a genuine, surreal masterpiece of weirdness and a kind of calvary of embarrassment, really. So I think real connoisseurs of strangeness, my recommendation is don't wait to see it on television. Try and see it in the cinema. And I don't know what you should do beforehand. Drop acid, maybe. Maybe you don't need to drop acid. Maybe the film kind of does that for you.
So it's this Bellatar. You know.
This is Bellatar, exactly. Yeah. He makes Bellatar look like the Marx Brothers. I mean, it is so slow. It really is slow. I mean, we're talking about Tarkovsky. I mean, this is seriously very, very slow. It is very bizarre.
On that note, Peter Bradshaw, thank you very much. Charles Dickens England will be getting a very short release as of this Friday. So catch it while you can. A big thank you there to Peter Bradshaw, and if you want to read all his reviews, just go to guardian.co.uk/film. With the 2010 World Cup finals almost upon us, all eyes are fixed on the host nation, the new South Africa. Skin, starring Sophie Okonedo and Sam Neill, tells the story of a black child born to a white Afrikaner couple, and the social and personal cost imposed on the family by the apartheid system. Director Anthony Fabian came into the Film Weekly studios to tell us about his film, but let's first hear a clip from Skin.
Thank you. You may go.
Wait, wait. Aren't you going to ask about her background, her education, about us, her parents?
We've seen what we needed to see.
So you see that she is white?
We'll notify you in a few weeks as to what we've determined.
I'm telling you, she's white. I'm her father. I'm as white as you are. This is her mother, undeniably white, and Sandra is our daughter, blood of our blood.
So, Anthony, welcome to Film Weekly. Nice to see you. We've just heard a clip with Sam Neill's character declaring his belief that his daughter is white, and therein is the essence of the film. I understand that it's based on a true story. Can you tell us how you stumbled across it?
Well, I first heard an interview with Sandra Lang on Radio 4, in fact. Peter White, the blind correspondent, had gone out to South Africa to interview a few people and heard her story and gave a very moving account of it, which I found perplexing and brought me to tears. And I knew immediately that there was a feature film lying in that story, but also that there was some reparation work to be done for the person at the centre of that story.
So what was Sandra's situation at the time?
She was living in a township east of Johannesburg, very little income, struggling to pay her children's school fees or buy them clothes. Meanwhile, her white family had prospered, and that was one of the things that had shocked me about the story was that simply through an accident of genetics, her fate had been completely different from that of her family.
So can you explain a little in a little detail about what exactly her situation was? I mean, obviously the film goes into it in some depth, but if you can sort of summarise it, I suppose.
Well, effectively, when she was born, her parents were perhaps a little bit shocked at her looking darker, but babies look lighter anyway when they're first born. In fact, one of the challenges of making the film was Sandra has a younger brother who also looks mixed race, because it was a throwback. It was a genetic throwback.
Is that definitely what the situation was, as far as we can understand it, that her parents were, you know, to all intents and purposes white, but there was a sort of genetic quirk that meant that the child looked mixed race or coloured or whatever?
Absolutely. There are many instances in South Africa of families where people within one family appear to be of different races. That's because the genes play all kinds of tricks, and sometimes they skip generations. So you might have black genes lying dormant, which won't express themselves for a generation or two, and then suddenly, bang. I think in this case, both parents must have had enough black genes to produce a child that was quite substantially darker than themselves. And for me, although there wasn't a DNA testing at the time that she was born, the proof positive for me that it was not the mother having an affair with a black man is the fact that they did then go on to have a third child. Sandra had an older brother who looked white, and then a younger brother who looked very like her and also very like the father, except that he was lighter skinned and his features were less pronounced as African. So to me, it would have been just impossible for this family, who were in any case confirmed racist National Party supporters, to, after all they'd been through with Sandra, then go through it, you know, again. It would have just been insane. So the birth of the third child is what really convinced me that it was a genetic factor.
Have you had any contact with the white family, as it were?
I was lucky enough to meet Sandra's mother before she died. I first came across the story in 2000, and Sunny Lang was still alive. She was in a nursing home outside Pretoria, which was about an hour and a half from where Sandra was living. So in that first weekend, when I went down to meet Sandra and to try to gain her trust, I took her across to the nursing home to see her mother, and there was obviously genuine warmth between them. And after Sandra left the room, or I left the room, of course, to leave them alone, but afterwards, when I came back to fetch Sandra, her mother said to me, her mother asked me, "Who are you?" I said, "Well, I'm a friend from England." And she said, "Are you taking Sandra back to England with you?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Look after Sandra for me." And I think that told me volumes about what her daughter had meant to her.
Are you aware that the whole sort of history of it had any impact on them? Because, I mean, that's one of the most interesting aspects of the film, where you have, as you say, this sort of confirmed racist Afrikaner family who have to deal with this. And in the film, the mother deals with it a lot better than the father.
I think this entire family were victims of that system. Although Sandra perhaps suffered the most, every single one of them suffered, and it had an incredible impact. It tore that family apart. And what it didn't, however, do was change the white family's attitudes about race. And that's one of the big surprises, if you like, because normally speaking, you would have thought that they would look at this situation and say, there's something wrong with our society that's creating these problems. And instead, they simply looked at their daughter, and because of their own brainwashing about race, they saw her as white. They couldn't see her as black. And they thought that if they could legally make her white again, it would solve all the problems. And of course it didn't.
South Africa now seems to be, cinematically speaking, beginning to revisit apartheid. There are your film, and there's a number of others. Just wondered, having been to South Africa to make the film, do you sense that there's more of an appetite there for people to sort of look back at their past and sort of confront it a little bit?
I think it's very important with all of these regimes, whether it's apartheid South Africa or Afghanistan, Iraq, or, you know, going back to Second World War stories, I think it's very important to re-examine the past and the mistakes of the past in particular. I think perhaps South Africa is ready to re-examine it. Certainly many of the children going to school now had no experience of it whatsoever, and it's important for them to know the legacy of that system and how their parents were affected by it. The film actually has very strong contemporary relevance because it comes to the present day almost.
Right.
But also because issues of racism haven't been resolved. It's not like, you know, everything's hunky-dory, not just in South Africa, but elsewhere in the world. And I think particularly with a biracial president, you know, these questions of racial identity are very relevant.
And one very remarkable aspect to the film, obviously, is the casting, where you have Sam Neill and Sofia Canedo involved. Just wondered how they got on board.
Sofia Canedo, we sent the script to once. We had a very long script development process because it's a complicated story, and it's hard to tell anything to do with race without resorting to rather heavy-handed language and so on. So it took a long time to try and formulate something that would felt less unsubtle. But eventually, we did get the script to that point and sent it to Sophie. She had just been nominated for Hotel Rwanda, and I didn't think we had a chance. But luckily, she loved it and committed straight away. And Sam Neill was somebody I had thought about very often along the way, and I had certain concerns initially about whether he would be tough enough, because he has a gentleness about him. But he, you know, more than proved to me that he was capable of showing the more stubborn and difficult aspects of the father's character.
Well, thanks to Anthony Fabian there, and Skin is on release from this Friday, the 24th of July. And that's all for this week's show. The music featured in this week's edition is the marvellous soundtrack to Once Upon a Time in the West by Ennio Morricone. And remember, the best film news and reviews can be heard at guardian.co.uk/film. One thing you can look at on the site is an exclusive 5 minutes from the Watchmen film and hear Zack Snyder defending his film. But now, from me, Andrew Pulver, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.